My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success. I've been telling everybody that our government is shady. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with your...
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know? If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You know, just tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
Shadows on the street corner, scabs with sores who fiend for more. The poor once begged door to door, now they're destitute, expiring human excrement, rotting cores, plotting their next score. Shot in the arm, slumped to the floor. Smoke soars from tinfoil, souls spoil. Crooks and crooked smiles, hooked on piles of powders, fed on dog chowder. The madness is getting louder, unavoidable shadows on street corners, illegals lured to cross the border, domestic chaos and disorder, destroying the brick and mortar. My patience is getting shorter as we're segregated to online quarters. Today we are discussing Crooked Smile, what it took to escape a decade of homelessness, addiction, and crime, by Jared Klickstein, who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and enjoy this episode with Jared Klickstein.
I think we are having a spiritual crisis in this country, and a lot of these people, like these people in the vans, these people have an ideological religion almost in the state, and I disagree with that. But yeah, these harm reduction vans. So harm reduction starts in Seattle in like 1986 or something, and it was started with clean needle exchanges. And fast forward 20 years, I mean, harm reduction becomes a giant industry in the mid 2010s, and to the point that the local governments in, like San Francisco, Los Angeles, and then the state government of California are allocating hundreds of millions of dollars to harm reduction. So we end up with a situation where people start these nonprofits, and then they have access to millions of dollars in grants. And you can get millions of dollars in government money to just hand out crack pipes. And I don't know if people are really aware of this, but you know, fentanyl is the main drug on the streets right now. And people don't shoot fentanyl, people smoke fentanyl. Okay.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back again in it now on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And I'm very flattered to have this guest on today. He's somebody who I was aware of. And then you come to find out, you know, this show has grown to the point where people like Jared are listening to the show. Who knew? So Jared Klickstein is joining us here. He's the author of A Crooked Smile, which is a fascinating take on a lot of issues that I think we're all aware of. And it's a take that he shares from his own experiences, his insider perspective. But without me saying anything, Jared, give us a little introduction and maybe where should we start? Because I feel like we should go through your story a little bit. Obviously, we want to leave a little, you know, fat on the bone for people to buy the book, but The Crooked Smile is a fascinating journey, your journey from being basically a homeless drug addict. And, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, they have a lot of judgments, a lot of preconceived notions, maybe even a bias around something like homelessness or drug addiction. And, you know, as somebody who's seen a couple of your interviews, like, you have a way of telling your story that is kind of shocking, you know, to know you've gone from the depths of that. And, you know, I know Sam Tripoli fairly well, so I've seen it in his life. Like, it's kind of, you know, I can't even imagine what he was like when he was addicted to meth. So obviously you're a completely different person now. But yeah, I want to thank you for joining me on the show to share your story, because I think it's a very important journey that a lot of people, whether they've walked, you know, in your shoes, so to speak, or not, can relate to it. So where should we start with this, Jared?
Yeah, well, first, I just want to thank you, Mark. I'm really honored to come on. So yeah, thanks for welcoming me. Yeah, so you sort of summarized it. You know, I was a homeless drug addict. I was homeless on Skid Row in Los Angeles, which is like a, you know, there's most cities have a Skid Row, but Los Angeles has a pretty famous one. And I was also homeless in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, which is also sort of another famous spot. And it is odd how, like, a magnet, you just end up getting attracted to that place. You know, you just, like, get dragged down like a magnet almost. But yeah, I mean, my story is kind of all over the place. I mean, to begin, I you know, my parents were drug addicts, so that probably plays a role in why I became a drug addict. Maybe, I don't know. But some people say it's genetics. Some people say it's a combination of, you know, genetics and your sort of, you know, trauma-based situations in your childhood and things like that. But yeah, it's interesting, because my dad became a heroin addict when he was about 13 years old, at the sort of like a year or two into the Vietnam War. So his old friends' older brothers were getting drafted and then coming back completely addicted to heroin. And that's how, you know, he got introduced to the drug. And like him, I got addicted to heroin, you know, about 5 years into, like, the Iraq war, you know, war in Afghanistan. And, you know, whether you want to connect those things or not, I don't know if there's a connection, but it does seem like when we invade places that have the perfect climate for poppy cultivation, there usually is a heroin epidemic in this country after.
Yeah. Strange. Strange how that correlates, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And of course, my journey takes me all over the place. I mean, I end up going to jail for a long time. And an interesting thing about jail in LA County is that there's an entire dorm dedicated to veterans, which sounds nice, but at the same time, it makes you wonder, why are all these veterans going to jail? And, you know, a lot of them became heroin addicts and started committing crimes to support their habit and all that. And or just PTSD, you know, having outbursts of violence and things like that. So yeah, so I guess I'll just, yeah, I could just kind of start. We all know what Oxycontin is.
Yeah.
You know, you being from Connecticut, I'm sure you saw something like that. And
well, you're maybe a little bit older than me by generation, but I definitely remember when Oxycontin was a factor, to the point where I think it was like middle school, which is tremendously young for, at least from my perspective, for kids to be playing around with that kind of stuff. But unfortunately, that is the case. I learned. I was very naive at that age, but I remember hearing like rumors of kids doing pills on like a ski trip or something that the school, you know, organized. And my parents never had the money to send me on like a ski trip or anything like that. But I remember hearing those rumors and being like, what, you know, what's the thrill in that? You know, that just never vibed with me, prescription, anything. But it was definitely a huge like wave of, I don't know if it was, I guess you said post-Iraq war or during the Iraq war. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was definitely a little too young to know exactly what was going on, but I heard little, you know, as much as a middle schooler could gather about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of, you know, I guess we are a little bit different in age, but yeah, during that time, probably like 2008, 2009, Oxycontin just sort of explodes. And I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why it's like so readily available at that time to kids, to everybody. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew what heroin was. And my parents were heroin addicts. So I didn't want to mess with it, really. I didn't want to mess with heroin. And I went to UC Santa Cruz. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's a like a sister school of UC Berkeley. And when I showed up, a lot of people were doing heroin, you know, like 18-year-olds just in the dorm smoking heroin. And there was like people coming up to the campus and selling heroin to kids and stuff. It was like crazy. It was crazy, you know, and I was really against it because I had been taken away from my parents when I was 12. And, you know, my mom died from heroin and all this like crazy stuff. And I just witnessed my parents' downfall during the 90s and really wanted to stay away from it. But then these pills were floating around too. And I didn't know what these pills were, but I figured that they were safe since they were pills. You know, they were pills like Tylenol or heartburn medication or whatever. You know, I just thought it was pretty safe if a company made them. So we started doing those pills. And pretty shortly after, this documentary came out called OxyContin Express. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was extremely informative. And unfortunately, I had already started doing OxyContin and was physically hooked pretty immediately. And I watched this documentary, and in the documentary, they explained that OxyContin was essentially heroin. It was essentially the same thing.
Right.
And, you know, it was coming out of Florida where you could get these easy prescriptions. They were flying it up to like Boston and Kentucky and all that. And then eventually these pill mill, you know, doctors ended up sort of nationwide, and it had hit California a few years later than it did the East Coast. But so quickly we realized that these pills, you can swallow them, but also you can crush them up and you can snort them. You can crush them up and dissolve them in water and shoot them. And most interestingly, you can put a pill right onto a piece of tinfoil and smoke it. And this is crazy that you could like take a pill and smoke it. Eventually in 2012, they made a tamper-proof version of OxyContin that wasn't smokable. But that was, I think, nearly 15 years after the pill had hit the market, and hundreds of thousands of people had destroyed their lives and tens of thousands had died.
Right.
So, you know, this, I don't know. It's just crazy that it was so clear that this was ruining people's lives, you know?
Yeah. No, and I mean, I know friends whose older siblings have passed away way too young, and it definitely, as much as it hit Massachusetts, it hit Connecticut equally, I'm sure, and yeah, the entire East Coast. And it was something that, you know, maybe because of DARE or whatever, maybe my generation, I mean, there was definitely kids doing it amongst my generation, my peers, my grade. But I was very sensitive to the propaganda, and I had seen enough like alcoholism in my family to be like, I'm not really interested in, you know, heavy drug use, no matter what it is. Eventually, you know, I caved into cannabis, but that's definitely on the softer side of things. I've talked a little bit about my addiction to cannabis and nicotine here on the show, but, you know, obviously this is a level of addiction that supersedes, and it's something that I think, you know, there have been a few, I don't know, lawsuits, but for the most part, these pharmaceutical companies that basically legalized or gave a legal version of heroin to people, you know, have they been held responsible? I don't know. I've heard of the Purdue family to some extent being held responsible for OxyContin, but at that point, you know, there's so many other hands in the mechanism. So give us like the hands on the ground or feet on the ground perspective of this. Like, did you, when you were, this was in UC, this was what, in California?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And it was just everything, the drugs were pretty much a part of the campus culture, basically. Like, this wasn't just your decision. Like, other kids were doing, you know, OxyContin, and it just became a part of your life.
Yeah. And I think things have changed a lot. I know my cousins are like 18, 19 years old, and they've never done drugs. And, you know, a lot of their friends have never done drugs. And, you know, maybe they drank a few times and smoked some weed. But it does seem like we're moving in a, even though the death toll is much higher than it used to be because fentanyl is so much deadlier, it seems like kids are abusing drugs and alcohol less statistically. But, you know, I'm 35 years old, so I guess a millennial, and we used drugs. I mean, drugs were really big, and it was just everywhere. And what's strange is that it was for, quickly, OxyContin, your tolerance skyrockets. And once I found out that it was essentially the same thing as heroin and I couldn't afford to keep up an OxyContin habit anymore, I switched to heroin because it's so much cheaper. And people were doing it, but by sophomore, junior year, a lot of people sort of stopped because they got scared because they saw some people really destroying their lives. And then some people had to drop out of college and some people sort of just remained addicts. And then some people like me turned into extreme addicts, but we tried to hide it. And I hit it pretty well for a while. But the interesting component is that heroin was about $30 or $40 a gram in 2008. And then come 2009, all of a sudden prices went up to about $90, $100 per gram, except this heroin was about 10 times more potent than the heroin that we were previously getting for about $40 a gram. And I wondered why. You know, I talked to the guy that I was buying it from, and he just said this is like a new kind of heroin. And I did some research after, and basically, Mexico was growing poppy. Mexico had poppy fields, and they weren't that good at cultivating poppies, not nearly as well as the Middle East. And I believe in 2009, maybe, when Obama cut a deal with Iran, where he agreed to, there's a Newsweek article about it. This is how I found out about it. He agreed to take the DEA off of Hezbollah, who was operating in South America and Central America with drug trade. He agreed to take the DEA off them and not put so much pressure on them in exchange for some kind of like nuclear deal or something like that. I'm not blaming Obama. It's just interesting that, and I don't think he foresaw the unintended consequences of this, but my belief is that after that deal was made, Mexico stopped cultivating poppies and started importing raw opium from the Middle East. And it was a much higher quality. And all of a sudden, there's a crazy heroin boom where the quality just skyrocketed. And people get incredibly addicted and really start dying and all this. And at the same time, the pharmaceutical industry and, like the FDA and all that start making it a lot harder to get OxyContin, because they're recognizing like, okay, the OxyContin is becoming a huge problem. We need to make it a lot harder to get it. And they sort of stop prescribing it. And unfortunately, in like a vacuum, a heroin explosion occurred, because people just, instead of just quitting drugs, they just transferred from OxyContin to heroin. So this is like 2009. And, I just get really addicted to heroin. And right through college and senior year, I get offered a job through my drug dealer, who was cartel affiliated, to deliver heroin in exchange for money. And I would work from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and deliver half grams of heroin around Santa Cruz. But a requirement for me to take this job was that I had to do meth. They wanted me to do meth. And I know that sounds crazy, but it's actually kind of a good idea, because when you're driving and you're a heroin addict, heroin addicts tend to fall asleep and nod out and crash the car. And then all of a sudden the police are there, and it could turn into a bad situation. So the cartel required their drivers to snort meth before each shift so they wouldn't crash the car. But an unintended consequence of this was that I got incredibly addicted to meth. So, heroin, you can manage a life. I mean, my dad held a job for like 30 years on heroin. Wow. But meth is really unmanageable in terms of like remaining sane, remaining employable, remaining responsible for a regular schedule, things like that. So once I started doing meth, it was like I immediately just stopped going to class. I immediately stopped paying my rent. I got kicked out of my house for being a crazy meth head. I started hallucinating and doing, typical tweaker stuff. And so that's sort of how I became homeless. People wonder how drug addicts become homeless. And, a big factor in why drug addicts become homeless is because, well, they can't hold a job and all their funds go to drugs, but at the same time, they sort of start to destroy all their personal relationships. So a lot of people may fall on hard times, but they have like a grandmother or an aunt or a friend that will let them crash with them or rent a cheap room or something. But drug addicts tend to, they're not bad people, but you need to get high. And, you know, one thing leads to another. Maybe you steal something. Maybe you get caught getting high in the house, you know, things like that. And people sort of just, some people faster than others, but they'll sort of kick you out or stop enabling that behavior. They don't know what to do. So
right.
That's basically how I became homeless.
Now, take me through some of the, like, the thoughts and the ideas, because, you know, in your mental plane, like, it seems like heroin is almost like, you know, they call it a downer, right? It's almost like taking you into like a sort of suspended animation in your mind where things kind of feel warm and time's really slow. Like, I've never done this. So what were your like thoughts and ideas like when you were addicted to heroin? Were like, how did you, because obviously you're rationalizing the addiction, right? So there's some part of you that's like, I love this. And then obviously the chemical dependency of, you know, the feeling and the lack of the feeling. But what were some of the thoughts and ideas that came with that?
Yeah, heroin is a downer. So it's also incredibly euphoric. I mean, it's one of the biggest blasts of euphoria that you can feel. So when you use heroin, you sort of lose all of your humanity. I mean, you lose all your senses. Like, you lose the sense of pain, obviously. That's why they prescribe it for people that are in pain. But you also lose your sense of smell. You lose your sense of sight to some extent. I mean, you can't really read when you're on heroin. Things become a little bit blurry up close. You know, you completely lose your sex drive, and you don't really want to eat, and you can't use the bathroom. You can't have a bowel movement. I mean, it's very difficult. So you kind of like become a lump of, you know, human remains. It kind of takes everything away from you. It numbs every sense. So what you want to do is just sit down or lay somewhere and just kind of space out for 8 hours.
Right.
And, you know, you're in heaven in your head, but you sort of create this, you know, incredibly serene and tranquil space inside your mind, and you shut off the outside world. Whereas meth is an upper, and meth does the exact opposite. It heightens all your senses, you know, to the point that you're like overthinking situations, to the point that you're hallucinating made up scenarios, and you get very paranoid, and
right.
It sort of turns the world into your playground, and you can't sit still. There's no laying in your bed for 8 hours when you're on meth.
Right.
You can't even watch TV. I mean, you got to be running around doing something.
So this is kind of why I asked, because this is like a huge transition here. Like, you go from basically being like a lump on a couch to, you know, driving around heroin on meth. So your life quickly became, yeah, a meth, I guess, frenzy, right? Like, you went to an extreme end with it. You didn't, you know, because there are people who keep down, you know, truckers or whatever, who will use meth occupationally. But that wasn't the case with you, obviously. I'm curious, though, about like the paranoia and all that, because, you know, here in the conspiracy theory world, like, yeah, we got a lot of paranoia, but usually it's well placed. I don't know that that same thing can be said for methamphetamine users, but it does fit into this world of conspiracy, especially when you learn about the origins of meth. And I'm sure you've heard, maybe you've even heard me talk about this on the show, how JFK and Marilyn Manson and a whole bunch of other stars from the 60s and notable people from that era were being dosed with methamphetamines by this former Nazi doctor who had moved to America and turned his life around to become, like, you know, a celebrity doctor.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think JFK was getting injections he had some kind of like back issue. Mm. I don't know why meth would help that, but, you know, but yeah, I mean, speed sort of powered a lot of what we know of as of like the 60s. You know, like, the Beatles wouldn't be the Beatles if they weren't in Hamburg for like 2 years playing 90 hours a week on speed. Mm. You know, that's where they became the Beatles.
Interesting.
You know, so without speed, I don't know if we'd have the Beatles. You know, I don't know if we'd have the Rolling Stones. I don't know if we'd have a lot of jazz, or rock and roll, things like that. So now, meth is like a, you know, in a pharmaceutical sense, it can be a very useful drug and it can be a relatively safe drug, you know, like Adderall. I don't take Adderall. I don't think everyone should take Adderall, but obviously Adderall is a lot safer than meth. But you know, crystal meth from the street, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's definitely not coming from like a pharmacy and you get wild, you know? And yeah, you know, I'm into conspiracies obviously. But it's a different world because conspiracies are sort of like, this world is built on us trying to figure out the truth and trying to put together puzzles from the past. But it's based on, you know, building blocks of factual information. Whereas meth paranoia is incredibly egocentrical and self-obsessed. It's all about you, you know, it's all about they're after me, you know? So the conspiracy world is not, that doesn't really jive with the conspiracy world. It's not about they're after me. Right. It's really about answering questions about the world and us.
Right.
You know, so drugs create especially uppers create like a very self-obsessed, egotistical view of the world.
Right. And
yeah,
you're in Santa Cruz when this happens, but eventually you make your way to probably the most infamous portion of the United States as far as drugs, next to maybe like Kensington and Allegheny and Philadelphia or whatever, the, you know, maybe like the Tenderloins in San Francisco, right? But Skid Row is a hell of a place to be. How'd you end up there from going from selling heroin, you're on meth? I mean, basically your life falls apart as it should on meth, right? But like, what drew you to the Skid Row rather than like, I don't know, anywhere else?
Yeah, well, I probably could have just lived in my car and just kept selling heroin. But the cartel told me not to smoke meth. They said, you know, they give me a line of meth in the morning. And then I started buying meth on my own and I started smoking it. And I will attest to that. When you smoke meth, you do get a little bit crazier. You know, when you snort it, it's sort of semi-manageable, but when you smoke it, you really do start to go nuts. So the cartel actually, I got pretty paranoid. And when I say the cartel, I just mean a guy that was like within the umbrella of cartel distribution. I started getting really paranoid and I accused him of working with the CIA to take me down. You know, me as in like just a tweaker, you know, not important. But he at that point knew, okay, this guy, he's smoking it. He's gone crazy. So I got fired is basically what happened. And I was homeless in Santa Cruz for like a month and I had never been homeless and I couldn't really make it work. So I eventually reached out to some family in Los Angeles and my uncle down there said, listen, I'll get you into rehab. I'll give you one shot. If you make it, I'll help you, you know, I'll help you get back on your feet. If you fuck up and you get high one more time, I'm never talking to you again. So he got me a Greyhound ticket down to LA. I went to this rehab and, you know, rehabs are pretty corrupt. I didn't know that. He didn't know that. I had insurance through my school still, even though I got kicked out. My insurance lasted into the next quarter. So, you know, this rehab gladly took my insurance money and I got high pretty much the whole time I was at the rehab and they didn't kick me out, but they always give you like these little punishments. They're like, you know, no hot tub tonight, or, you know, you're not going to the beach with us tomorrow. And because they don't want to kick you out because they're making like $1,000 a day from you.
Yeah.
So they always give you these like fake punishments, but eventually I did get kicked out because my insurance lapsed. And that's when they finally kicked me out. And they also called my uncle and told him that I had relapsed like 9 times since I went to that rehab. So he wrote me off. But the way that I was relapsing was that I'd get a day pass and I'd take the train down to Skid Row. Because I asked someone, you know, where can I get, I've never really gotten high in LA. Where do I get heroin and meth? And they said, well, you just got to take the train down to Skid Row. So I'd become familiar with Skid Row by buying drugs there. But once I got kicked out, I really didn't know where to go. But I knew that when you're homeless in LA, at least back then, that's where you go. You go to Skid Row. So that's what I did. I went to Skid Row. And at the time, I don't know if you remember this, but there was a Occupy Wall Street movement.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, this was like the heat of the Occupy Wall Street, and there was an Occupy LA, and it just so happened to be right next to Skid Row, downtown. And so that's where I sort of like got my training wheels. I like camped out at Occupy LA, and you know, someone gave me a tent, someone gave me a sleeping bag. You know, they had food, they had supplies. And I basically just started doing like low level crime to support my habit, and then eventually moved from Occupy LA to Skid Row proper. Once I sort of got my bearings straight, and that is difficult because I'm like not a very intimidating guy. I'm not very big. I'm not very scary. I was, you know, 22 years old. I looked like a kid. I was like a college kid, you know, so people on Skid Row don't take too kindly to those kinds of people. Mm. So it took some getting used to, but you know, I basically turned into a full-fledged Skid Row homeless guy. And at that point, they accept you because they see that, okay, you're not just here for like a little vacation. Like, you're fucking homeless on Skid Row, you know, like, mm. you know, you're one of us. And people sort of start leaving you alone. But, you know, there is pretty much daily violence, or at least threats of violence or altercations. Violence is very, very regular thing.
Right.
Because everyone's kind of fighting for a tiny amount of resources, and the resources being $5 to smoke crack, or, you know, it's
right.
It's not like you're fighting over food. I mean, there's plenty of food.
Well, and I've heard that about LA from comedians who are familiar with New York City, where they go out to somewhere like Los Angeles and they're like, oh wow, the homeless people are a lot more aggressive, you know. And I wonder if that's not just because of the tremendous amount of money that's moving through New York City in the places that the homeless people are, whereas even though LA is equally wealthy and there's equal amounts of economic opportunity, Skid Row is like geographically segregated from those areas. And you know, I've never been there myself, but I could just guess that there's probably not a lot of rich people floating through Skid Row handing out $5 or $10 sympathy notes. Whereas in New York City, you know, it's a little easier for homeless people to get down to Central Park, or, you know, where Times Square, where there's plenty of people walking. I mean, not so much anymore with everybody, you know, using cards, but back, you know, 10 years ago. Yeah. I remember when I would take the train down to New York City when I was a bit younger. That was like, you couldn't walk by people without getting asked for money, but it was never like a threat. It was always just like, hey, man. And then they would be disappointed if you said no. It really felt like more like haggling and salesman's type stuff. Whereas Skid Row has like an element of, you know, we'll cut you if you don't, you know, play along with what we want from you. Right. And I mean, again, never been to Skid Row myself. I don't think we're that far apart. You said you were 22 in 2012, around there. So yeah, we're only like 4 years apart. I just turned 30 this past month. But yeah, I mean, again, like there are levels of homeless desperation that certain areas of the United States you lend themselves to, like maybe San Francisco versus Skid Row. It's a little different, but still same issues applying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, people generally do what you allow them to do. And, you know, in New York, at least when I lived in New York at one point, and this was after I lived on Skid Row, and, you know, you weren't allowed to do anything. You just weren't allowed to do crime. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't even, I got arrested twice for hopping the turnstile at the train.
Right.
You know, I hopped the turnstile like 3 or 4 times. Two of those times I went to jail.
Yeah.
You know, so New York, I haven't been in New York in a while, but when I lived there, I didn't witness a crime. I mean, you couldn't do crime. I mean, I bought drugs, but that's about it. And it was very secretive and it wasn't out in the open. Whereas on Skid Row, well, Skid Row was going through a kind of a change at the time, because Skid Row is a very secluded area. It's there's no stores. There's some warehouses and stuff, but it's not like,
it's an industrial type of area.
Kind of industrial, yeah. Like even Kensington in Philadelphia, like there are some stores and some things going on, and people live in Kensington. Like
right.
People that aren't drug addicts live in Kensington. No one lives on Skid Row. You know, there's no like, they have, When I was homeless down there in like 2011, 2012, they were starting to build like the first lofts, you know, where like hipster kids could go and get like a loft for a little bit cheaper, you know, but in general, no one really lives there, but there was a downtown boom at the time. So Skid Row, you know, is a 10 by 10 block area. And then just right adjacent to it, right east of it is downtown, the downtown center. And that started to become cool around 2010, 2011. All of a sudden you start seeing like boba shops and vape shops and nice restaurants and, you know, hipsters walking around. And so all of a sudden, you know, when I get down there, all of a sudden there's, for the first time in a long time, there's like people you can rob, you know, actually in the vicinity of Skid Row. So people start robbing people, you know, because before there was never really, there weren't that many targets, but then there was a lot of targets all of a sudden. So, and obviously Occupy LA created a situation where there was a lot of targets because a lot of people at Occupy LA meant well, but they were, you know, a lot of them were just well-off college kids that were kind of naive to street smarts and street scenarios. And a lot of those people got robbed and taken advantage of. And that was one of my assets to people on Skid Row, was that they knew me as a Skid Row drug addict, but someone that could blend into that college activist
right
scene, because I looked, you know, I kind of looked like them, and I could get, and I did do some bad things to those people. I mean, I didn't do any crazy violence or anything, but you know, I stole a lot, and you know, I'm not proud of these things, but that was sort of how I first gained trust of a group of homeless Mexican guys that were ex like street gang members that sort of had succumbed to meth addiction so much that they had been kicked out of the gang. And they took me under their wing because I could, well, first I gave them gifts. I gave them like socks, and, you know, I'd steal underwear and socks and food and all kinds of stuff. And I'd come give it to them, and I displayed value to them, I guess. And in exchange, they showed me the ropes and offered me protection. And I joined their crew basically. And yeah, and there was, but most of the money that I made that run was going to the Union Station. It's like a big train station, and giving a sob story to people. And just, you know, I looked like a 22-year-old kid. I just told them that I got robbed and I was, you know, living in Occupy LA to, you know, fight the 1%, and someone jumped me and now I need to get home. Can you give me $20 so I can get a train ride home? And people, you know, showered me in money. But I found myself homeless on Skid Row again in 2015, 2016, looking a lot more haggard and a lot more strung out and a lot scarier looking. And that strategy did not work at all during that run.
So what happened in between there? Was that the rehab time when you were in between being haggard in Skid Row the second time? Like, what was there a time where you were sort of, you know, getting your life together and then you hit rock bottom again? What was in between the Occupy Wall Street time? Because I remember Occupy Wall Street's effect on, you know, the small city here in, you know, Connecticut that I live near or used to live near. And yeah, I mean, it's still, I mean, I think it's a major reason why there's a lot of homeless still to this day, because there were certain trends that were set or patterns that were set at that time period with the encampments, and a lot of them, even though they got cleared out, there's a lot of people who never were able to get back their former lifestyle. Maybe they were like a naive college kid. Like I might have been that kid, you know. I was hanging out around that spot, and my parents definitely thought I was crazy enough to go and, you know, be homeless, right? And I remember researching like how cheap it was to live in Venice Beach and thinking to myself like, oh, I'll just drop out of college and go live on Venice Beach, you know. And I'm sure a lot of people like had that kind of idealistic like, oh, let me go and just try to live homeless somewhere where the weather's nice. And you know, through whatever circumstances, it turns into drug addiction and just goes south from there. But yeah, was there a time after that Occupy Wall Street period where you kind of were making strides to get your shit together, or what was going on there?
Yeah, there were. Real quick, though, I agree completely with what you just said. And I think that we saw that again with COVID. Mm-hmm. I think with COVID, a lot of people went a little nuts, and maybe they were getting a big unemployment check or something like that. And a lot of people said, you know what, I'm going to drive to San Francisco, or I'm going to drive to San Diego, or I'm going to buy an RV and just drive around. And some of those people, you know, kind of just stayed where they were, and or maybe they got addicted to drugs from the trauma and the stress of lockdowns and all that. And I mean, we saw a big wave in California of specifically RV homeless people during COVID. And my theory is that people got like the $1,200 check, or maybe they got an unemployment check, and they thought, well, I'm too cooped up here, I'm going to buy an RV and just drive out west. And, you know, now there's like hundreds of RVs in Oakland and San Francisco. And I think, yeah, just kind of like the Occupy thing. And I'm not like blaming, you know, I think Occupy was cool. I wasn't against Occupy or anything, but yeah, it definitely, I think, contributed to some of that stuff. So
yeah.
So to get back, I guess on Skid Row, I kind of like hit a bottom. You know, I couldn't walk anymore. I went through a situation where my feet got all fucked up, and I was just totally strung out, and I just couldn't move. And I just kind of rolled myself up into a carpet and kicked heroin for a few days. And then this guy from a church, he was driving around Skid Row handing out water, and he discovered me, and we talked a bit, and he was a former heroin addict, and he actually offered to take me to his house so I could detox heroin at his house or complete my detox. So, you know, this guy sort of just like saved my life, or just peeled me off of Skid Row and got me out of there. And from there, he was like, hey, I think you should go to Salvation Army. I think you should go to one of these programs. And, you know, he couldn't force me. And I just said, you know what, I think I'm fine. I'll figure it out. I'll make some phone calls. And he said, all right, man, you're probably, you know, if you don't go to some kind of like long-term treatment or something, you're probably going to end up doing drugs again. And I, you know, I just didn't listen to him. And I ended up making some phone calls to some friends in Oakland, California, and they bought me a Greyhound ticket. I went back up there, stayed with one of them for a bit until I became a really big nuisance because I was doing heroin and meth again, and they kicked me out, and I ended up homeless in the Tenderloin in San Francisco for, you know, about a year, I guess it was 2012, 2013. And, you know, that was similar to Skid Row. You're just, you know, I was homeless in the Tenderloin, and, you know, it's definitely a different atmosphere, but same day-to-day stuff. And then eventually I made a phone call to my dad, who was, you know, a heroin addict, and he told me that he got sober. He was like, hey, I've been sober for 4 months. I got into this like halfway house in Florida, and I told him my situation, and he was like, well, shit, I'll buy you a Greyhound ticket. Why don't you come down to Florida? You can move into this halfway house and, you know, you can detox. He's like, I don't have a detox for you, but just kind of detox on the Greyhound. And, you know, when you get here, we'll figure it out. So I that was like my first time. I was sober for 4 months. Maybe five, something like that. But I started to get my life together. I got a job. I started saving up some money. I didn't use drugs. I was around people in a community of people not using drugs. It was really therapeutic. It was great. And I saved up enough money, and I said, you know what, I think I'm going to move to New York City, because I had a friend in New York City. And I went to New York City. And interestingly enough, I relapsed pretty quickly and started doing heroin, but I didn't become homeless in New York City. Actually, I did become homeless for about 2 weeks, but you weren't allowed to be homeless in New York City at the time. You couldn't like just sleep outside. So you had to go sleep in the shelter. So I went to the shelter for 2 weeks. And while I was at the shelter, I got a job. And then I found a room to rent in Harlem for $150 a week. And my dad sent me $300 for me to sort of get on my feet and get my first paycheck so I can move into that room. And I just kind of lived in that room, did heroin, did Suboxone. You know, sort of did this shuffle where I would get high on the weekends and do Suboxone during the week. And I went to work and rented this shitty room, and it was terrible. I mean, it just wasn't that fun. It was, New York was not, you couldn't like commit crimes. I was really scared of getting arrested there. I got arrested multiple times, you know, I just couldn't get away with anything. So from New York, I said, you know what, I'm going back to California. And that's what I did. I went back to California, and man, I went to Florida and got sober again, bought a car, saved up like $2,000, then went to California.
Right.
And then I lived in my car in Oakland, California for like a year, and just kind of like did the same shit, you know. But eventually someone in Los Angeles that had gotten sober, someone that I had gotten addicted to heroin with at UC Santa Cruz, I called them and they said, "Hey, I've been sober for like 2 years. You got to get down here. I'll hook you up with like my whole sober community and we'll get you into the rehab that I went to." And, you know, she was like, I'll help you. So that's what I did. I went down to LA and I didn't do what she said. I just kept getting high. Eventually I got arrested and they took my car away and I ended up back on Skid Row. So that was my second run on Skid Row, 2015 to 2016.
Right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors. Of course, first and foremost, The Hit Kit, with some brand spanking new designs with no moving parts. They're amazing stuff. And if you have your own small business or even podcast, any sort of brand, you can get custom hit kits with your logo on it. So give it a shot. Spark one up with The Hit Kit. Go to The Hit Kit on Instagram or hitkit.us for more information, and be sure to use the promo code CRAZY. And folks, if you're interested in optimizing your mental wellness, well, you're in luck. Brain Supreme is a product that you should look into. It's not a psychedelic, get you high type product. This is a micro dosing wellness supplement. And with the promo code CRAZY25, now until November 1st, so act now, folks, you can get 25% off your order of Brain Supreme. So go act now, check it out at brainsupreme.co, and be sure to use the promo code CRAZY25 and get a new lease on your liminal life. The plasticity, the optimization, it's next level stuff, folks. We've also got Oregon.ite. That's right, Oregonite. Oregonite made in the great state of Oregon. My friend Isaac, who's been a guest on this podcast. As a matter of fact, all of our sponsors have been a guest on this podcast. Adam Shell at brainsupreme.co, promo code CRAZY25. Garrett B at The Hit Kit, promo code CRAZY. And Isaac Lazell at Oregon.ite. Use the promo code CRAZY as well with Oregon.ite. And last but not least, Crazy Optics. That's the promo code for Raw Optics. If you've seen me on any podcast lately, or if you've seen me in a live stream from my car on Instagram, you may have noticed my new sunglasses. Yes, these are Raw Optics. They look great. And with the promo code rawoptics.com/crazyoptics, or just the promo code crazyoptics, that's a promo link. But rawoptics.com/crazyoptics to get 10% off your order of Raw Optics. Because we aren't just doing this to look stylish, folks, okay? I'm doing this, and you should be too, to block out all the blue light. I'm getting exposed to blue light every time I sit down and record this podcast. So from now on, I'm going to be minimizing the detrimental effects of this artificial light on my eyes, okay? The organ of light. So affect yourself in a positive way with Raw Optics, rawoptics.com/crazyoptics for more. And it's not just these aviators that I'm wearing. These are the Yoganandas. They've got a ton of other frames, so choose a style that works for you. All that really matters is that you block out the blue light. So, again, Raw Optics, that's rawoptics.com/crazyoptics, CRAZYOPTICS.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
Yeah.
Right. And that
was a convoluted story.
No, it's not. It's not. And I appreciate you taking us through it all. Obviously, people can get all the details in your book, but, and I encourage them to do so. The link will be in the description. But yeah, it's just fascinating. You know, I think a lot of people will point the finger at a certain place and say, oh, it's San Francisco, it's LA, it's New York City, it's Seattle, right? And you've been to all these places, so, and you've experienced, like, you know, the bottom of the barrel of at least, you know, two out of the three. I know New York City, you know, you're in the shelter, but, you know, that's pretty much as bad as it gets, right? So not a great place to be, but, you know, for the times we're in right now where so many people are just writing off homeless people, like, well, you know, we're never going to be able to solve these problems, so let's just find a place to shove them, right?
Yeah.
It seems to me, like, from what I've gathered so far from your story, like, you had all these opportunities to get clean, but the you know, mechanisms that were there to help you were more geared towards exploiting you. At least they seemed like they were going to help you. And I mean, that must not have felt great to have that first rehab experience and realize, oh, this is just some kind of racket. It doesn't give you much faith in that process, right? So was that part of why this second rehab or this sober community didn't really stick, because you had already kind of been run through the gamut with that first one? Or were you just so thrown into this addiction that, you know, there was nothing that could really sway you at that point in time?
Well, that second sober community, it wasn't a rehab, you know, so no one was making money. It was a sober living with about 60 men, and we all paid, I think, $150 or $160 a week to live there. But, you know, the guy that owned it, you know, he'd let you move in 3 weeks free, you know, go look for a job, you got 3 weeks. And if you get a job within 3 weeks, you can stay there. You know, it was a very, like, selfless situation where this guy, you know, wasn't making a lot of money, but helping a lot of people. And it helped a lot of people. I mean, my dad got sober there. I know dozens of people that got sober through that. And it was a great, great program in Florida, but, and they didn't take insurance or anything, you know, it was just completely separate. But why didn't it take? I mean, listen, drug addicts, sometimes it's going to take a few times, you know, with increasing levels of consequences that finally sort of shake you awake to the reality of your situation. And I just hadn't been shaken awake yet, but you're right. I mean, things have changed a lot since 2014, 2015, where, you know, the rehabs have remained, the private insurance rehabs have remained relatively corrupt to some extent, but there is an entirely new industry that is sort of like farming homeless people. I mean, these people are getting paid directly from grants from the cities and the states. And we're talking, you know, billions of dollars. I mean, we're talking the city of San Francisco alone spending $1.1 billion a year to eradicate homelessness. And it just keeps getting worse. You know, so there's just a giant industry now that isn't really in place to eradicate homelessness. It's more in place to maintain homelessness. I call it urban farming of the homeless. They are basically extracting wealth from the tax base in order to babysit the homeless and sort of corral them in a certain area.
Right.
And which is fine. I mean, whatever, if you want, I don't know why it has to cost $1 billion for a city of 800,000 people, but in the state of California has spent, I think, $24 billion just from a state level in the past 10 or so, or since Newsom became governor, I think in, man, what was it? Was it 2000? might have been 2016. I forget when he first became governor. But yeah, so we end up with this situation after Occupy where there's an influx of people my age that went to college that got degrees that didn't give them hard skills. They gave them soft skills, such as maybe they majored in history, maybe they majored in sociology, maybe they majored in Chicano gender studies, you know, as Adam Carolla likes to say. But, you know, we end up with a generation where there's like millions of kids that went to college that can't actually make a living with their degree. So with that pops up an entire industry of like the nonprofit industry where they could employ these people. Not that these people are unemployable, but they just kind of fucked up in their path, just like me. I mean, I went to college, I majored in history. It didn't exactly set me up for a life where I make 300 grand, you know, or anything like that.
Same here.
So it's kind of like this, it is sort of a quagmire of multiple things intersecting at once, where we just have all these people that are like hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt from college, but it isn't worth anything. And then we have this industry that is sort of propped up by an inflated tax base in California. So, and also it coincides with just like a broken ideology that starts coming out in the mid 2010s that sort of treat drug addiction as like, they treat it as something that it is a sickness, but it's a sickness that these people are really the victims of like capitalism or victims of American consumerism and the you know, they're
well, and I get where you're, yeah. It's almost like it's been coached into this or couched into this mental illness awareness kind of, it's almost like a very superficial, like, oh yeah, we need to be aware of mental illnesses without actually addressing the cause of a lot of these mental illnesses, which are very clearly societal, cultural, very related to our industrial modern world. And to your point, drug addiction, I mean, there are a myriad of routes that bring someone to that point. But the truth of the matter is that if you look at a place like, you know, what are they called? The blue zones, where, you know, you have very healthy lifestyles. They don't have these kind of issues in those regions. And there's a reason for that. It's because the people have a wholeness in their life. They have a holistic relationship with their world that is complementary and fulfilling. And there's no void that needs to be filled with drug addiction. And I think in our American culture, we don't have much sympathy for that because we're all victims to it to some extent. And we're all so beat down by coping with the machine that we almost lose empathy for others with this compassionless kind of like machine. And again, I don't mean to victimize because, you know, to your point, and I think you made this point on another podcast, not this one, but you know, drug addicts tend to be extremely selfish and very self-destructive. And to that end, it goes beyond just a mental illness because they start affecting their community, their families in really negative ways that, again, don't lend very well to their problem because nobody wants to help you when you've screwed them over, right? So we do kind of live in a culture where it's very much oriented towards this kind of, and I hate to use the Darwinian kind of cliche, but it's very much a survival of the fittest mentality in a lot of ways that's posed upon us rather than like naturally taken on.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, we are all victims of this system that has sort of gotten out of control and it has left us, a lot of people, in a situation where they have nothing to actually fulfill them and to create a sense of self-worth. And a lot of this ideology that has spread it up in the last 10 years is all about establishing drug addicts as victims, but it really has nothing to do with, okay, well, how are we going to fix it? You know, they just keep taking billions of dollars and they just keep promoting this idea. And I don't even disagree with the idea. I just like, what are you doing to fix it? And that, you know, I like RFK in certain ways because I think our food supply does play a huge role in it. And I think, and he was a heroin addict, you know, so he definitely has an insider knowledge of addiction. You know, the guy got clean in 1988. But it's not just the food, you know, it's obviously, I think we're overprescribed medication as opposed to finding other more fulfilling cures. I mean, people need a sense of self-worth and a sense of purpose and a sense of usefulness. And that's where, you know, people don't really like 12-step stuff, I know, but, you know, 12-step groups at their very core, you know, you go into it and if you have one day sober, you can be useful to a guy that has 0 days sober. And you just, it is like almost a, it's really interesting because it's like kind of a socially conservative group and almost like a very traditional conservative group. But at the same time, it's like the most communist thing that exists because no one's ever made a dollar from it. You know, like AA, you know, I know people have problems with it, but no one is, it's like a group of people drive to this room and all help each other and no one makes any money.
Right.
Every day. It's crazy. You know, well,
so. It's incredible too, because the amount of stand-up comedians that have gone through AA, at least the ones that I'm a fan of, you notice how it's made a really deep impact on their life and brought out this side of them that was always there. But because they didn't maybe see that, they were gripped in this drug addiction. And I think that's part of maybe why people are like, oh, I don't want to hear about AA, because obviously a lot of people who are in AA, it's anonymous. You don't even talk about it. But I think for comedians, you know, they inspire people like yourself. You know, you're in front of a crowd of people on a weekly or daily basis. Like, you're inspiring people to laugh. You're inspiring people to think. You're inspiring people to be moved. And this is something that, you know, inevitably lends itself. I think there's also like a public speaking and a confidence element to AA that also lends itself to stand-up comedy. But there is a trend, like, you know, if you counted the amount of like famous stand-up comedians who are also in AA, if they're open about it, you know, it's a pretty big number, right? So there's something to it. And I don't think it's necessarily like always 100% agreed upon, but what is agreed upon is that it's helped a lot of people. I think where it becomes a little bit interesting is when, and I wonder your thoughts on this, because Sam Tripoli, obviously we both know Sam very well, and Sam talks about his sobriety, but he's also open to something like mushrooms. You know, he's not opposed to psychedelics in certain instances. Do you have that same openness? Is that something that you kind of noticed in AA, is that they're very, you know, sobriety is like a very hard line, like, you know, you can't cross, right? And like, maybe there's some people who are kind of like, I don't need all that.
Yeah, this has been a topic that has been pretty heavy in AA the last 10 or so years, and things are changing. You know, things are changing a bit. And I mean, the general idea in AA is to thine own self be true. You know, whatever you consider sober is technically sober. I mean, as long as it's working for you. And I'm not opposed to that kind of, I believe that psychedelics should be utilized in our society for many reasons. I'm down to experiment. I mean, listen, like, I don't know how many veterans shoot themselves in the head every day, but like, why not? Why not give them some mushrooms and see, right. Let's see if this works. I mean, you know, why not take some of these studies seriously that show that like MDMA can have a therapeutic value to treat trauma? You know, like, we're not really doing anything and these guys are just shooting themselves.
Yeah.
So I'm very open to it. For me personally, I'm going to stray away. I'm not closed-minded to it for the rest of my life, but currently I don't think I need to use psychedelics to overcome any sort of blockage spiritually or anything, but if you do, I mean, I'm not even opposed to, like, you know, creating these camps where we can get homeless people that are addicted to drugs into them and teach them like a very valuable skill in society that can help them earn a decent living, and maybe doing some psychedelic therapy. Or I'm down to try an array of therapy. You know? Right. I'm not like, you know, like, people accuse me of things and they say like, oh, Jared just wants to put everyone in jail. And it's like, you know, if you read the book, I mean, that's not what I say. You know, I don't want to put everyone in jail. But you know, there is a point where when you are a drug addict and you're homeless and you're sort of in public and you're lashing out on people, I mean, I'm all for, listen, I think people should be allowed to do drugs. Mm. You know, I'm just sorry. That's what I think. But I think if your drug use is starting to impede upon the civil liberties of anyone else, i.e., you're smoking fentanyl in a playground, you're causing a scene at a restaurant, you're throwing your shit at someone, I mean, you're attacking people, you know, then we have a different situation, and you should probably be apprehended and not necessarily sent to jail, but sent to like a therapeutic environment.
Right. I'm with you to a certain extent. You know, we've seen places like Portugal do things to that measure where they say, okay, we're not going to criminalize these substances anymore. And it seems to be very successful because it removes the black market element of drug addiction. And I mean, maybe that is the solution, but it does seem like in America, you know, putting our conspiracy hats on, that there's a certain element of this drug crisis that's manufactured, and certain drugs are so destructive that I don't think there's even a spiritual use for it. Although in the higher order of things, you know, when we look on our lives and we think, you know, back, like, you know, maybe these things are meant to happen to us in a spiritual way. We're meant to, you know, live the life of walk in the shoes of a drug addict temporarily. You know, unfortunately, some people never come back from that because of the, you know, the damage it can do to you. But I wonder, like, you know, going back, I know prison was kind of like another rock bottom for you, and then also what helped you become who you are now, right? Because obviously you got sober through that process and have changed who you are and changed your life. But when it comes to like going back to, you know, the young you that started this journey, you know, obviously coming from a family that had these kind of scars, and maybe a lot of people would say, oh, well, that's why you became a drug addict, Derek or Jared, because your parents were drug addicts, right? Like, but in your mind, in your heart, like, do you see it that way? Or is there, because you talked about self-worth and the way you see yourself. And I wonder, like, what was available to you at that age? Like your culture, your the things you were consuming? Because the 90s for me, like, I think about grunge, I think about, and even the early 2000s had like a very superficial kind of element to pop and rock music. Like the culture was very vain and superficial, and maybe even not empathetic, you know. I don't know, maybe that's just my bleeding heart, whatever, sympathy. But like, where were you at that age? Like, did you have a lot of hope for yourself as a person? Like, did you even think about your future at that age? Like, what was your life like that age, you know? Like, what were you kind of thinking about? What were you consumed with?
Yeah, I didn't think about it too much. It was, you know, the 90s was a time when it was assumed that you would be okay, you know, no matter what. It was a time of, at least the late 90s was a time of economic prosperity for America. We had sort of established, I mean, it had been decades, but with the new tech revolution, we had really established ourselves again as, okay, the 20th century was the American century. It looks like the 21st century is going to be the American century all over again. You know, so it was, you know, my dad was didn't go to college, was a carpenter. By the late 90s, he was making $50 an hour in the union. And he was like, you know, you're going to go to college and you're going to make $200 an hour. Cause I mean, I make 50 and I didn't go to college. So you're going to go to college and obviously you're going to make a lot more money. And now almost 25 years later, you know, carpenters don't make $50 an hour. You know, maybe in the union, they might make 55, 60, but it just shows you that, you know, 25 years ago, the union wage of a carpenter hasn't gone up that much. Whereas the price of a house has gone up 10 times or something, you know, it's something crazy like that. So I was actually pretty hopeful in the 90s. But there was a toxic element of our culture. I mean, I was incredibly obsessed with wrestling and Kid Rock and Eminem and Korn. And you know, it was kind of like a dark, man, it was kind of dark back then.
It's funny you mentioned Eminem, because I got back into collecting like CDs and stuff. I was like on the tail end of CDs, right? Like when I was a kid, like CDs were kind of like people were over it, right? Because the iPod had just come out, right? But I've gotten back into collecting CDs, and I ordered like a, you know, I don't know, some kind of like, CD, and the guy said he'd send like two other CDs from the same genre, right? So I get an Eminem, the Slim Shady LP, in the mail, which I didn't order. I'm not really a big Eminem fan. I was when I was younger, but I listened to it just for like, oh, let's see what it's like. And it's so like dark. It's like he's talking about molestation. He's talking about drug abuse. He's talking, and to a certain extent, like, people wanted to hear that because before that, maybe that wasn't a part of modern, you know, what was acceptable mainstream culture. You know, that kind of stuff was pushed off to the fringes. And here's a guy who's saying, oh, no, I'm going through all this stuff and I'm also really cool and like look up to me and blah, blah, blah. Right. So it is. Yeah, I'm glad you pointed out because you gave me a flashback to when I was just listening to that Slim Shady LP. He's talking about killing his baby mama. And I had to turn it off because I'm like, I'm done with this. Like, this is too dark. Like, I don't want this energy in my life. And, you know, I don't know, obviously hindsight's 2020, but looking back, like, I wonder if there was more of a spiritual pathway for you if you would have just avoided the drugs altogether, right? And maybe, you know, religion or spirituality was a part of your life. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. We haven't talked really much about that, but I'm curious just from that perspective of looking at this whole issue as a whole, like, you know, some people have a religious element because of AA. There's a whole kind of like higher power element, right? And did you at all think about that when you were a kid? Because the 90s were kind of atheistic, kind of F the man, F the church. Like, I remember that kind of vibe that I got from a lot of my peers and people that were older than me. You know, they were all kind of like, no, screw church. Nobody likes church, you know? So I wonder, like, and that was like a Roman Catholic. I went to Roman or Catholic church, probably similar. If you're in Boston, there's tons of Catholic churches up there. But yeah, was that at all a part of your life, or did that only come about, you know, when you became sober, like this spiritual awareness?
Yeah, that's a really good point. The 90s were incredibly atheistic. Obviously, the 80s, there was like the, what do you call that? The
evangelist.
Yeah, like the battle, like the Satan, what do they call that? Like where they were freaking out about Satan.
Oh, yeah. Like the apocalypse was coming, like Book of Revelations type stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And like all this Ozzy Osbourne and all this metal.
Oh, you know, okay. Satanic Panic. Yes.
Christianity and pop culture.
Satanic Panic. Yeah.
And pop culture won. And that's the 90s. I mean, the 90s is this time where, you know, girls are on TV, like shaking their tits, you know, high school girls at spring break. People have no idea what's going on MTV in 1998. Eminem changed my life because I was living in a crack house with two parents that were incredibly unstable. And I was like, quote unquote, white trash. And I, you know, my life was dark. And then Eminem comes and he's like describing my life.
Right.
You know, and he was the first rapper to be self-deprecating. You know, there'd never been a rapper before him that's
a good point.
Said, hey, I'm fucked up.
That's a good point. It was a lot of, you know, I'm a gangster, I'm cool, I get women, I have money. It's always the brat, and it's kind of shifted maybe more to like the gang culture now, but there's still that element of braggadocious that's always been there in rap. But you're right, he did bring this self-deprecating, and there's not a lot of artists that have followed up with that. And there's a sort of rawness and realness in that. Yeah, for sure.
And he frankly fell off when he stopped doing that, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, when you get successful, you know, it's hard to be relatable. I mean, this is something that I think happens to a lot of celebrities, period, no matter the genre that they become famous in. You get a certain level of money and what made you relatable is no longer there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. So that was just unbelievable that a guy came on basically saying, like, I used to get beat up at school and I, you know, my mom's a crackhead. And yeah, it was just crazy. Like, it changed me, you know, it changed my life. But to get back to the bigger point, no, I was incredibly atheistic, almost violently atheistic, I'd say, in my mentality. This may surprise your audience, but I am Jewish. I grew up in a crackhead, blue collar working class Jewish home.
maybe the podcast we're going to have you on Monday with Danny Polichuk, but not this show. Maybe Sam's show.
I just say it because when you think Jew, you don't think, first of all, you don't think crack. Sure. Second of all, you don't think like white trash. Third of all, you don't think.
I see. I grew up in a blue collar area, and there was plenty of Jewish kids just like me. But there were definitely the rich Jewish kids for sure. But yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you.
So my dad's Jewish. My mom was adopted by Jews, but born Irish Catholic. I wasn't raised with a religion, and I had a real anger towards religion, and I was like a Reddit atheist, you know, kind of like insufferable type of person.
I was very similar for a certain point in my life. I was just right there with you. I was a little too young to really get my, you know, points out there, but around 16 or 17, I smoked weed for the first time, and that kind of opened my eyes to spirituality. And I always been very, still to this day, very, you know, shy about any sort of hard drugs. I mean, I've had it offered, like, you know, hot chicks that I was dating, and I find out that they do that, and I'm like, I'm done with you, right? So like, that for me, I'm not trying to put myself on any pedestal here or anything, but for whatever reason, maybe even the 4 years in difference in age, like my generation didn't get as exposed to that as much. I felt like maybe, you know, I was exposed to it to a certain extent where I was just like turned away from it. But yeah, it's very interesting. I want to ask you to join me on the show for another 90 minutes, if you will, maybe in like a couple days, and we can continue the story, because I know there's a whole other portion of this story that takes place with you being in prison. And I feel like there's a lot more we can talk about still, because, you know, homeless people, whether addicted to drugs or not, are being exploited in these ways. And you have a firsthand experience of it, which I think is tremendously valuable. And I don't know if I'll put both episodes out as one, or maybe put this episode out and then we'll do a follow-up very soon. But if we do it in that way, the latter way, where there's a follow-up and people are hearing this before the second part comes out, send me any questions that you have for Jared that you'd like me to ask, if you have any, you know, firsthand experience. But Jared, I didn't even get your answer, yes or no.
No, I'm definitely down. Okay, yeah, cool. I'd love to do that. I'd love to continue about the spirituality, because that ultimately, I will present, like, that does play a huge role in sort of my turnaround.
I get that sense.
Yeah,
I get that sense. And I do relate really heavily to that. And like, you know, although I didn't go down the route of hard drugs, like there was a point in my life where atheism and like this existential, like not giving a fuck about anything could have really sent me down the wrong path. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, kudos to you for turning it around and becoming a positive example for people. And, you know, not this show, but other podcasts I do, like Sam Tripoli's show. I mean, tremendous. I maybe have, but it's not as frequent. But there, with Sam's show particularly, he'll get messages all the time from people who have been through, you know, the ringer with drugs, and say, wow, your show really helped me. And thank you for being honest and being a positive example of what sobriety can look like. Because unfortunately, the way the news and the way these, you know, multi-million dollar nonprofits operate, you know, they give people this sense of helplessness. They leave them feeling used, and it's because they are being exploited. And you have firsthand experience of this. This isn't just like the outside looking in. You know, we can sit here as observers, you know, all day and criticize something, but you yourself have been through this, and you can, I mean, say definitively, like, yeah, these people are not being treated in a way that's going to actually help them. I had to go outside of those, you know, what you'd think would be the routes to receive help to actually help myself. You know, this is something that, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people's families might think they're crazy for saying something like that. And sadly, yeah, that's probably a position a lot of people can relate to, you know, whether it's themselves or family members who have gone through drug addiction or friends. You know, you expect something like a rehab to help them, and it ends up just perpetuating their, you know, illness. This is something we should all be aware of. And even, I don't know your opinion on these guys, but I've seen on the East Coast, there are these vans that'll drive around And they're like usually like marketed, like they'll have like the whole wrap on the van with like their company's logo and whatnot. And they'll just be like, I don't know, like mobile addiction. It'll say something like mobile
yeah, like harm reduction.
Harm reduction, right. And so I definitely want to ask you before we wrap up a little bit about that. And again, we're going to continue this conversation. So we'll do a part two. Obviously, the links and whatnot to your book are in the description. But yeah, what are your thoughts on those? Because that seems like another exploitive element. And I'm only going off of like firsthand experience judgment of like running into one of these characters and just getting a bad vibe from them, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is a huge point of contention in the modern approach to addressing addiction as like a public health crisis. And first of all, yeah, I mean, just to say, like, I think we're having a spiritual crisis in this country. And a lot of these people, like these people in the vans, they believe, in a way, they believe that the solution is God, but they view God as the state. And, you know, like that's a weird way to put it. But
no, I get that.
These people have an ideological religion almost in the state. And I disagree with that. But yeah, these harm reduction vans. So harm reduction starts in Seattle in like 1986 or something. And it was started with clean needle exchanges. And I have nothing against clean needle exchanges. I think that people should, you know, have resources to not spread HIV, especially in the late 80s when HIV was killing a lot of people.
Right.
HIV isn't really what it used to be, but it's still obviously a terrible disease. So these started out as like nonprofit centers based on donations. And then we fast forward 20 years. I mean, harm reduction becomes a giant industry in the mid 2010s. And to the point that the local governments like San Francisco, Los Angeles, and then the state government of California are allocating, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to harm reduction. And so we end up with a situation where people start these nonprofits and then they have access to millions of dollars in grants. Now, if you want to start a rehab, you know, a genuine rehab, you can get a grant, but then that you have to build a rehab. I mean, you have to build a rehab with a physical building, a staff, doctors, you know, outpatient treatment, aftercare treatment. It requires a lot of work. Or you can just buy a van and get like a $20 million contract to hand out crack pipes. Right. So it's sort of like the path of least resistance. A lot of people went for the latter, and you can get millions of dollars in government money to just hand out crack pipes. And I don't know if people are really aware of this, but you know, fentanyl is the main drug on the streets right now. And people don't shoot fentanyl. People smoke fentanyl. So this created a kind of a big issue with these harm reduction nonprofits, because without the need to exchange needles or give out free needles, what's the point of harm reduction? You know, no one's really shooting fentanyl anymore. I mean, no one's really shooting drugs anymore since fentanyl has replaced heroin. So now these vans hand out tinfoil to smoke fentanyl on, and then they hand out meth pipes and crack pipes. These are routes of administration of drugs that don't spread disease. I mean, you can't get HIV from sharing tinfoil with somebody. So yeah. It's become like a complete sham. And I know people that make $30 an hour just handing out tinfoil to drug addicts. And you know, are you really helping someone by like approaching a tent and like knocking on the little zipper door and saying like, who wants tinfoil? I mean, you know, that's not really, if you want to do that, fine. I don't think you should be getting millions of dollars in taxpayer money to do it.
Yeah, no, that's at that point, it's not even in the tradition of the initial concept where they wanted people to not spread HIV. I mean, to my knowledge, there's no real need for clean tinfoil, right? And regardless, like, of what people are smoking it out of, like, I'm sure they'd find other ways to smoke it if they didn't have tinfoil, right? Smoking something's not that difficult. I'm starting to get concerned now, like, as a stoner, like, this is going to change the way I interact with people, because I'll never, you know, share a blunt or a joint, you know, if it wasn't rolled by me, I'm not going to, you know, go and smoke. Like, especially like when I was 18 or 19, I would go down to the Green in New Haven, which is where the Occupy Wall Street situation happened. And I would just smoke weed, and homeless people would come up to me and smoke. And sometimes they would have their own weed and smoke. And, you know, I've never been big on smoking other people's weed, but now I'm even less interested, especially, yeah, someone who lives on the street. I mean, not that that's something I'm seeking out, but yeah, it's a scary time to be in, Jared. And again, I really appreciate your perspective. Obviously, we got to cut it short. I don't mean to do that, but I want to really dig into this with you and talk more. And maybe this will be like the addiction industrial complex episode, and then we'll move into the prison industrial complex episode, because both are exploiting people in a similar way, you know. And it's, you know, it's a big part of what we talk about on this show. The medical industrial complex is a pipeline to drug addiction in many ways. I mean, there's countless stories of people who were prescribed something by their doctor and then ended up going to the street because they couldn't fulfill, you know, whatever requirements to keep that prescription, or they lost the money or the insurance or yada yada, right? I mean, it's a terrible scenario to find yourself in, to not have your own free will. And unfortunately, that's what our society is built on in many ways, is exploiting your will. And it's not even just with, you know, addiction. It's with, you know, your consent and the terms and agreements when you click on a phone app or your, you know, whatever, yada yada. So, but Jared, you're the man. Before we go back to our we've come back with our part two, leave the people with the links to follow up with you. You're not just an author, you're also a comedian, right? So tell us where they can follow up with you and continue beyond this conversation.
Oh, well, first of all, I just want to say I'm honored that you had me on. Thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. I'd love to come back. I'm actually not a comedian. I do some writing and some journalistic stuff. I've been flirting with the idea of, I've done some open mics. I've been kind of flirting with it, but I definitely wouldn't advertise myself yet as a comedian.
Well, you fooled me. So you're already one step ahead. It's part of it is looking the part. So
exactly. So, but you can find me on Twitter or X at Jared Klickstein. Instagram, I think I'm at jclickst, or you can just search Jared Klickstein. And of course, the book Crooked Smile, What It Took to Escape a Decade of Homelessness, Addiction, and Crime is available on Amazon. It is a very informative book, but it's also a funny book. And it's just like, you know, if you want to get into the mind of a homeless drug addict from the perspective of a homeless drug or an ex-homeless drug addict, it might be the only book like that right now available. So yeah, if you want to learn about the guy that you see standing at the overpass screaming at himself, that guy's a human. I was that guy. You know, one of those guys wrote a book. So you can check it out if you want on Amazon.
Yeah. Thank you, man. I appreciate it. And it's funny, as you say that, I can think of books that talk about a drug perspective, but a lot of them seem to like idolize drug addiction. Like some of the, at least from the, you know, 20th century, like, you know, Fear and Loathing, which ever since I've got these sunglasses, everyone's calling me Hunter S. Mark or whatever, Mark S. Thompson. But yeah, there is like a drug part of the drug culture that can like pull you in if you're not aware of the real dangers. You know, it seems alluring, and it's definitely like ingrained in the fabric of what it is to be an American. I mean, so many people use drugs on a daily basis, whether that's, you know, Pepto-Bismol or cigarettes, alcohol. I mean, it's all a part of our daily life, and not just America. But Jared, you're the man. I look forward to the part two, and until then, folks, we'll catch you next part. And until then, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, here we are on the Patreon and the Substack for supporters only. And I'm a little bummed out because I missed my hymns ad that I was supposed to do for the month of November, which is $600 that I am not going to be getting now, and I better do it for the month of December because I'm gonna need it for sure after I buy Christmas gifts for people and whatnot. I'm always short on funds around the beginning of the year, so but I'm kind of happy in a way. It's bittersweet because I really don't want to be sponsored by Hims, you know, the erectile dysfunction and hair loss stuff. It's not really big pharma, but it's still in that realm. And I don't know. I'm just not interested in promoting anything that we, you know, talk about on the show in a way that, you know, it's like kind of counterintuitive. Like we're talking about all the problems with the medical industry and then I'm promoting dick pills. It's kind of, I don't know. To me, it feels hypocritical. So, but I didn't really have a choice because the Patreon hasn't grown much over the past year. And also there's a few other, like Rockfin kind of dried up, which that was a pretty significant amount of money each month that I was getting for the past few years, and that dried up. And I don't know, Rockfin, just people aren't using it or whatever, so I just stopped posting there. So yeah, I had to sort of turn towards advertising and sponsors, unfortunately. And it's kind of going against the original mission statement in some ways, but not really, because you guys still get the pure version of the show without ads, without interruptions, and the occasional rant like this. I don't know that many of you even care, but just what's on my mind right now. Jared Klickstein is a great guest. I'm looking forward to having him back on for a part two to get into the rest of his story. So yeah, if you do have any questions about him being in prison, or any questions about what we've just talked about, or maybe you've heard him on other podcasts and you have questions, send them to me on Patreon. Just comment on this post your questions, and I will ask him on the next interview that I do with him, which will be in the next week. So coming up soon. So if you hear this within the week it was posted and you have a question that you'd like me to ask Jared, please comment, and maybe even start the comment with the word question in all caps, or question for Jared, whatever you feel is best. And if you'd like me to give you credit for your question, since you are a supporter of the show, I'm more than happy to do that. Just make sure you include your name or how you would like to be called, whatever that is. I can call you by your spirit animal names, whatever spirit animal name you got back when I was giving out spirit animal names. Maybe I should bring the spirit animal names back. You know, maybe we'll do that for New Year's. Everybody who's a Patreon supporter on New Year's gets a new spirit animal name. Depending on how the election goes, we might be in a completely new country. So, yeah, we might need new spirit animal names. But anyways, that's enough from me, folks. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And thank you for supporting the podcast, whether that's on Patreon or Substack. Either way, I love you and I appreciate you, and I hope you immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. MFTIC.
Broadcasting the moon matrix from the lunar surface. They want you confused, like you never knew your purpose. Hopping through the portals, dismantling the machine. My family thinks I'm crazy, I can't believe what I've seen. Memories of a war, the Pleiadians and Anunnaki. Stuck within the genes of a copy of a human body. DNA fractal, the universe within me. Epiphanies of science is hoarded by the Illuminati. Puppet masters know the power of the mantra. Repeating mad lies till it has an effect on ya. Subliminal messages hijack your perception, tricking the population with holographic projections. We see through it, and the system is unraveling. I'm astral traveling through the library of the Vatican on a sacred journey. I embark with the squad, forever spitting truth like Mark on the pod. Gotta know the facts, never hold back, cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers, searching through the galaxy. You might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade. I awoke in a deep underground military base. Zero recollection of how I got to this place. Alien corpses floating in glass cylinders. Must have been extracted when they crashed into us. Animal hybrids contained in the cages. A lion with the eagle head. Monkeys with reptilian faces. Losing my mind and I'm feeling desperate. I look around the room and I see no sign of an exit. All of a sudden the wall flickers away, revealing a hangar full of spacecraft. My getaway, I run to the nearest one. See a guard, knock him out, robbing for his plasma gun. Hop in the ship, take the controls. They highly intuitive, I figure it out easily. Lift off, accelerate through a tunnel until I see the light. Fly into the sky, get flanked by six F-35s. Gotta know the facts, never hold back, cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers, searching through the galaxy. You might be feeling stressed out.
Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade.